Welcome to you all. This is our special session, Strategies for Jumpstarting the Revitalization of Desertified Ag and Grasslands. We really are honored to be here, and we're also delighted to have you all here. It's a great chance. We represent a team of researchers from the United States and China. We started working together in 2010, and our project has evolved through time. We've had a lot of successes that we're going to present today, some challenges. And basically, we're keep learning about how much more there is to do and how big an issue this is. The issue is that of global soil degradation, which is arguably one of the biggest problems facing humans. And we're going to talk some more. This is really what we're going to be focusing on all morning. And we're going to be presenting some of our successes and things that are working for us on using strategies for revitalizing degraded and saline soils. But the second goal is we are actually looking for feedback, right? We want to kind of find out how relevant this work is to what you all do, whether it could be tailored to the areas you work in, and guidance perhaps in new directions. And also, our work is like we're starting to get papers out, and in the scientific community, typically, you keep publishing, you put another paper out. But when we see how important this issue is globally, we realize this could take a long time. People, let those people come on in. You're fine. We're just getting started. Want to give them an agenda, Steve? That's great. Grab an agenda and some handouts. We have a nice small group, so this is going to be comfortable and informal, guys. Okay? All right, so what we really are realizing, things could go a lot faster because this is so important. If actually we had lots of people working on trying out restoration techniques, talking to each other, seeing what works where, and working collaboratively. So our vision is we actually want to develop a global, adaptive, highly networked program integrating research, stakeholders, education, and simultaneously start working globally. All right, that's our goal, is to actually start building this program globally. Our core team, you're meeting most of us today, and from Cornell University, it's me and Dr. Stephen Morielli. From Nature Forestry Institute, Director Regen, Dr. Niji Liu are here today, and from Southwest University, Dr. Li Shengxiao. And we're funded through a joint program between the USDA and the Ministry of Science and Technology. And this is the core group, but like any real effort, there's been many other people helping and giving us guidance. And so from Cornell University, a bunch of other people have been starting to be involved and are helping in different ways. From Southwest University as well. USDA, our first person to join us was Dr. Mark Liebig in North Dakota, who's amazing. And we held a workshop in 2014 in China, and Ray Wheel, Steve Schaefer were there. So people have been giving us guidance, and it's been really helpful and involved in different parts of the program. And this, in the past 4 months, we decided that we are taking this seriously. This is an issue that needs to be addressed, and the MacArthur Foundation put out a call, a $100 million challenge, solve a global problem. And so in the past 4 months, a whole bunch of people have said, this is relevant to what I do, I care about it, I want to be part of it. And so actually a lot of really good people have bought into this. And so the group keeps expanding, and hopefully we'll be able to get this actually to happen. So basically, this is like a class we teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays at Cornell. They're longer classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So we're going to have these five short presentations, but it's still about an hour and 40 minutes. So we'll probably get up and walk around a little bit to give you an overview of what we've been doing. Okay? Then we'll have a coffee break. And then the second part of this is really getting you to give some feedback about what this is, what would work, what stakeholders would think. Is it relevant to your area? What do you think about building a bigger program like this? What's it going to take? All right. So I'm going to give you the first of the presentations, which is a kind of a background. What is this issue about? But before I do, We're going to have another welcome from, just a short one from Director Li Jen from Ningxia Forestry Institute. And I want to read you her credentials so you know who we're very lucky. So Professor Li Jen actually is an amazing woman. She's director of the State Key Laboratory of Seedling Bioengineering. She's president of the Ningxia Forestry Institute. They made her a congresswoman to the National Congress of China. She's responsible for restoration for the entire, basically, province of Ningxia. She was responsible for a lot of the landscaping at the Beijing Olympics. She is responsible for 15 different nursery areas in different provinces across China. And so if you ever want to meet somebody who can make things happen and get things done, this is the woman. So she's been the driver behind what we do. Can you come up?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to be here and share our results with everybody, because you know this very successful fruits experiments opened from 2010, because very interesting story, long time. So between Cornell team and Ningxia Forestry Institute team work together, open a new field. First of all, want to open the problem about Ningxia problem, but experiment step by step is very interesting, can find very, very good results. So the big team, Dr. Schneider introduced about this step by step. We finished two projects in China. Not some good results can the problem about soil and selected soil for the Ningxia forestry. Ningxia forestry demonstration for the different place, especially in north of China. So the great team maybe introduce about the so much more detail, discuss with the top scientists together. So I think I want to thank you, join us. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's see the bigger context. And I see we have some young people in here, and I'm going to tell you, you're going to hear about some of the problems facing the world. I teach at Cornell University, and I actually, because some of these things are so frightening, I mean, when you see the scale of the problems, I do Good News Friday. And what you're going to hopefully learn by the end of today is we feel like there's a lot of good news. We have some solutions to this. So you're going to hear the bad news first. One of the key problems facing the world right now is the fact that we have to come up double the amount of food that's produced globally, basically in the next several decades, to feed the world's population. And there's two factors that are going to affect whether we can do that. The first is global water scarcity. Already, it's a huge problem. I argue it's more important than energy scarcity. And basically, depending on what articles you read, but one that recently came out, 4 billion people worldwide are affected by severe water scarcity at least 1 month every year. And that's when you look at it monthly. Up to now, we've been looking at it annually. So huge. Already, people are faced with severe water scarcity. In part, it's because of what we use water for. 70% of all water is used for irrigation. And this is a nice plot to show that, which is from the Pacific Institute. On the bottom is from 1900 to 2000. That's when it stops. Population growth is the top curve. And then what you see is as the population increases, all water withdrawals in cubic kilometers a year is directly in parallel with irrigated area. All right? Most of the water we use is going to irrigation, even though people are short of water worldwide. So 70% is used already for irrigation, and that's only used for 24% of our crops globally. All right? Irrigation delivers only a third of what our agricultural production is. So one solution to deal with food needs around the world is ag intensification. And so one people are arguing, we can do better. We can actually get more crop per unit area if we irrigate more, put pesticides in. And that's without thinking about, well, where's the water going to come from when we're running out of water already? And the water scarcity is being exacerbated by climate change. And so there are various models. This is 2014. And basically, by the end of the century, this is inches changes in how much water regions get around the globe, with yellow and brown being down to minus 20 inches per year. So there's California over there. And other parts of the world will have more water. Okay? But basically, we're changing the distribution of our rainfall. And if you think that's not important, here's the global drought, the extensive drought that's been happening in California. And in the United States, about 99% of our almonds, walnuts, pistachios, broccoli, strawberries, grapes, tomatoes, and lettuce all come from California. So if I want lettuce in the winter and have a salad, it's dependent on this area that's in the severe drought. So water and agriculture, huge issue. The second big issue is this issue of global soil degradation globally. Because when you have unhealthy soil, it takes more water to grow crops. And this is a photograph showing where we're working in northern China, where every single green tree has a drip irrigation tube. Okay, so water and water demand gets much greater with unhealthy soils. All right, so where is our agricultural growing? All right, and so recently they start synthesizing because of remote sensing. These are like some of the good things that are happening. Basically, almost 40% of the land surface of the earth is currently used to grow food. All right, greens and browns. Actually, croplands is about a 2-to-1 ratio of pastures for beef and meat to croplands. And so one of the solutions is if we stop eating as much meat, we'll have more space to grow other kinds of crops. And so that's one of the solutions being presented because, wow, there's a lot, most of that land, 40% of our land surface of the earth is currently being used to grow crops. This was, for me, a real revelation. In 2013, UNDP said, well, you know what's interesting? Of all the land surface on the earth, deserts and glaciers are a big chunk, forests are a big chunk, but a third used to be grasslands, and that's what we turned into agriculture. All of our agriculture now occurs on what used to be grasslands. Okay, that's really important. There's different types of grasslands, and so growing up, we always heard savannas are kind of like where lions occur. They're usually in like tropical areas. There's prairies, that's like our Great Plains. There's steppes, which these are like the temperate regions, but there's some confusion about that because we call this a short grass prairie, they call it a steppe. And so, you know, for 40% of the land surface of the earth to have it in three categories, in hindsight, I'm a wetland scientist actually, it's like, wow, there's way more types than that. And sure enough, right now, NatureServe is going out and saying, let's look at those grasslands. And they've come up with about 50 different kinds around the world. And so we're starting to pay closer attention to the differences in grassland types. This is the key point, though. Grasslands are naturally evolved in semi-arid regions, regions that get less than 600 millimeters of rainfall a year. Okay? Semi-arid. So all grasslands are evolved to be in semi-arid regions. That's the natural biome. And so Whitaker, back in the 70s, and an early ecologist said, sure, temperate grasslands, they get, you know, 0 to 20 degrees C, but less than 1,000 millimeters of rain a year, somewhere between 100 and 500. The key part is, though, these used to be super productive areas, okay? They used to support millions of bison, millions of antelope, millions of zebra. Okay, and then underground were tons of rodents and prairie dogs and insects, and then the birds that fed on all these. The primary and secondary productivity from grasslands is remarkable because they were semi-arid, because now we have to irrigate everything. So what happened? Okay. One of the key factors was that they had temperate grasslands had deep organic soils. They had a special name called mollisols. And it's a little intimidating to be talking at a soil science conference, but I'm not a soil scientist, and I'm talking like I know this stuff, but this is what we're piecing together. Basically, mollisols are very deep, high organic matter soils, 60 to 80 centimeters deep, okay? They're grassland soils that had deep organic. This whole area here of the U.S., large parts of the Asian continent, large parts of Argentina are all mollisol soils. That was part of the temperate grassland system. And here's the United States. This is all the percent of land area mollisols, and the percents range from 10 to 25, 25 to 50. This is 75% or more. Large parts of our region used to have grasslands. And that corresponds to our tall grass prairie, our mid grass prairie, and our short grass prairie. So what happened? All right. I'm using this as a case study because this was well documented, all right? We know what happened, and we actually have somebody from John Deere here, which is fascinating, all right? I'll look here. So what happened with the Great Plains was this. In 1837, John Deere invented a stainless steel plow. All right, it was the first time you could break up the grasslands. You make up that sod that held everything together. It was called the sod buster, the plow that broke the plains. He and his family, his son, his colleagues, sold 10,000 by 1855. And then we started a system of wind erosion and water erosion, and I'm adding here livestock overgrazing because this is what began to attack the grasslands that used to be there. In the 1930s, then the Dust Bowls came, which we had a drought, right? And now the grasses weren't there to hold, the roots weren't there to hold things in place. And it's all well documented. This is when all the erosion occurred. 16 million acres destroyed in Texas by erosion. The black clouds rolling over the prairies was the organic matter blowing away. In 1982, and there may be earlier than this, but NRCS started to monitor soil loss. And each one of these blue dots represents 100,000 tons per year of water erosion, and each red dot is 100,000 tons per year of wind erosion, okay? Starting to keep track of how much erosion was happening. That was 1982, almost 100 years after the stainless steel plow. Again, they did in 1982, 87, 1992, 1997, 2002, 2007, 2012, 2014, I can still get. And cumulatively, adding all this up, over a 30-year period, there was 400,000 kilograms per hectare, 180 tons per acre, that was documented as having eroded. And this is still happening. The question as we get into, wait, what is this? You know, we're trying to restore these. What are we restoring to? What we're trying to figure out is what was the initial condition when we're not even documenting the first 100 years? And maybe the word restoration isn't the right word. Maybe we can never get it back to what it was anyway. Maybe it's enhancement or revitalization. And we are happy with that, but still trying to understand how the system functioned and was so highly productive is what the question is. This was well documented. But when you look at agriculture around the world, it's actually been going on for 11,000 years. And so depending where you look, thousands of years without documentation have been happening with similar types of impacts. Here's another case from 400 BC. The island of Crete is in the middle of the Mediterranean, belongs to Greece, and if you go there, what you see is this kind of beautiful landscape, very kind of barren. But in 425 BC, Herodotus wrote, it is covered with shade trees throughout. Those were used to build ships, fuel for heating, fuel for wood, for cooking. Totally cleared. About 400 years later, the Venetian Empire said, from now on, nobody gets to take any of the remaining trees without a permit. There's so few left. But right now, all that's left is soil incapable of holding moisture. It's called a ferrugana, is the new type of vegetation there, which is spiny, aromatic, drought-tolerant shrubs. And that was the next time when we knew what was happening. Right now, in the pampas of Argentina, just recently, there's starting to be conversion, and that's relatively recently, to intensive beef cattle ranching and soilization, where they're doing soybeans. And we're getting input about how badly eroding now the system is. And so the question becomes, okay, this was the world's grasslands, these highly productive areas, and every one of them is now degraded and eroded. Dr. Lau has put together estimates that globally, the soil organic carbon stocks have been depleted by as much as 66 petagrams, that's 10 to the 12 kilograms. That's how much organic matter we washed away from the blue and got rid of from the areas where we grow our food. And that brings us to our work in northern China up here along the Yellow River. Here's Mongolia, and the Gobi Desert is right near us. The Yellow River runs through it. It's a steppe, it's kind of type rainfall, 200 millimeters of rainfall a year. It's home to 2.5 million people. It's a desertified grassland. It rains there about 1 centimeter every 10 days, and they're having to move people because the systems are so unhealthy, people can't live, really make a living. These are just some of the photos of where we work. These are the Gila Mountains, reminding me of Arizona now that I'm here in Phoenix. And there's the Yellow River, all right? This is the substrate we're looking at. You can see some of the Aeolian dunes right here. The Yellow River runs through and this is all irrigated. And this is the landscape, this is where we're working at the Ningxia Forestry Institute. And this is the landscape. And this is basically Asia. And so actually, we got there and we're looking for soil. It was raining, and it was like, wow. And we went to the museum and we found rocks, petroglyphs in those Helan Mountains right there that have grassland animals carved into them. And we said, wait a minute, this isn't a desert. This is actually should be a grassland. All the organic matter had eroded away. It's this whole issue of what's called historical amnesia. We get used to whatever we grow up with, and that's the new norm. And that's what we've basically come to say, oh, it's okay, this is the way it's supposed to be. But globally, we've basically eroded away all these productive areas. So the goals for this project were to say, well, wait a minute, organic matter is so critical, can we bring that back into the system? Let's jumpstart it back to a healthier condition, because if you put a grass and try and grow something there, it's going to die. I mean, it's just there's nothing there to get started on. And so what's the recipe? What are the steps for jumpstarting the revitalization? And now we're using that instead of restoration. Can we revitalize it? And of desertified and saline soils, you're going to hear some great exciting findings today. This really is working. And can we start actually getting them to be used for constructing either healthier croplands that require minimal irrigation? All right, so we can at least reduce the amount of irrigation, or self-sustaining grasslands that don't need irrigation. That's the goal of this whole project. And I call it recipes. What do you put into it? It's not a scientific term, but we do a lot of extension at Cornell, and you think, all right, what can people relate to? And soil amendments have been used forever. A soil amendment is any material added to a soil to improve its physical properties, such as water retention, permeability, water infiltration, drainage, aeration, and structure. And they've been used forever. Surface application of like mulches and compost. We actually decided to focus on coarse woody material. And it's also, and people put mulch on the top. I love mulch. I garden, put it on the surface all the time. But interestingly, not many people put wood chips underground. But in our mind, if I take most compost, they'll be gone in a month or two. They decompose so quickly. It's like, I say, iceberg lettuce. I put it underground, it won't be there next week. Can we use something that will be there much longer? And so we went with a coarse wood chip about a centimeter in diameter. And then, as Dr. Morial is going to talk about, Steve, we said, well, let's look at also using something to kind of shade and cool the system. We'll put branches or some kind of surface application. And that was the beginning of this whole development of a recipe. Okay, so that sets the scene. And what you're going to hear next are four talks about what are the elements of the first two are about the elements of the recipe that we've got some data to show here's what's working, what's not. Then the third talk is going to be actually about looking at the microbial community, which because we don't really know, do we need to add some kind of inoculum, some microbes, what's going on with that? And the last talk is actually about we this past summer started using it in hypersaline soils and had some really exciting results from that. And so we see a lot of good things that are working, and this is actually what's called the Bajitan Desert, which is right near Ningxia. And the villagers have been working for 30 years using this strategy just to keep the sands from blowing. And they push straw into the ground in 1 meter squares just to stabilize it. Some of these are actually 30 years old. That's like 30 years old. And so it's a strategy, but it's not quite the right solution. Okay.